Session number 2552. Session number 25574, Reel 6.
There's great rejoicing. There were thousands of people to welcome back this fair sultan, and there was dancing, and there was food like I've never seen in my life. It was a marvellous experience to reinstate this sultan. Having said that, it was rather different when we were reinstating the Dutch elsewhere, because the colonial Dutch were clearly hated by the Indonesian population, by the indigenous population. And on one occasion, I realised later we'd come up against what was the nucleus of the Free Indonesian movement. And they just did not want, under any circumstances, the Dutch to be reinstated. But that was our job, to reinstate the Dutch, because the Dutch, it was Dutch New Guinea when the war, the Dutch East Indies when the war started, and our job was to reinstate them. And I remember arguing the point. This fellow said, well, if you leave one Australian, it'll be all right. And I said, well, sorry, but I can't leave an Australian, but you'll be all right. Anyway, somehow or other I managed to reinstate, to get the Dutch reinstated. But they were not welcome. And, of course, subsequent events have proved that the Free Indonesian movement flourished, and ultimately the Dutch left, and they're running the country in some sort of a way now to suit themselves. Another occasion, the name of the place doesn't matter very much, but we lay off this island, and the natives came out paddling, they were called praus, I think, boats with outriggers on them. They picked me up. Why they picked me up, I don't know, but I was selected. And, I could speak a bit of Indonesian. I had to pick it up. And, of course, a lot of these people could speak reasonable Japanese. So between the Indonesian and the Japanese that I knew fairly well, we could get by. Anyhow, here we are going up this river, that they're paddling like crazy and they're singing at the top of their voices. It was as if I was an admiral or a general, the welcome I received. And I'll never forget this. The outriggers on this boat were almost touching the mangrove on the side. And we pulled up at the village and went ashore, and there was great rejoicing, and there was food and there was booze, and as I said, it was just like as if I was royalty. But it was a very very happy occasion. I'll never forget that.
What was the occasion? What was the reason for the fact celebration?
That, the reason, there were troops there that to show that the war was over. The war was ended, that the Japanese had gone. I was the figurehead, if you will, of the fact that the country had been liberated from the Japanese. Oh yes, yes.
I was the figurehead for the liberation. That's what it was all about. Because if you think about it, they were fairly isolated and they hadn't seen, they wouldn't have had any visible representation that they were free. They've probably heard it on the radio, but I was the prize. Yes, here we are, we're free. Free of the Japanese. And they, I forget the name of this strong drink, but you'd see fellows running along with a big bamboo strung vertically down their back, and they had obviously punched most of the, it was hollow, it would have punched them out, and they had this white drink, pure white or watery coloured, and it had a kick like a mule. And there was one fellow who was with me, Eric Nixon Smith, the Nixon Smith's own Smith's Weekly, and somewhere or other Eric got stuck into this, and oh, he was a real cop case, and he didn't want to come back to the ship, and I had some difficulty getting Eric back, but that's another story.
In relation to your job as interpreter, in relation to that situation, you were mentioning earlier on that a lot of the Allied soldiers, commanders, didn't fully understand the way the Japanese viewed war and the principles of war. What did you mean exactly by that?
What I meant by that, I think, was that having been fortunate enough to study the Japanese language, and also I was interested enough to read the Japanese documents, and I had a fairly good grasp of the Japanese mentality, particularly in relation to the war. I was in the position of knowing that, but I'm quite certain as I look back that a number of our officers understandably had no idea of the Japanese ethos as far as the war was concerned, and I don't think they understood, for example, that you never surrender. And that's why the prisoners of war, one of the reasons the prisoners, Australian Allied prisoners of war of the Japanese, were mistreated in the way that they were. I think that answers the question.
In relation to the way the Japanese then were to see their position on surrender, how did that show itself in relation to your knowledge of the way they went to about making war?
I repeat what I said earlier, it was because of what Hirohito said, that you will lay down your arms, that they laid down their arms. Now, having said that, they were soundly defeated. They were buggered. MacArthur had cut off their supply lines. They were reduced to farming, or getting the natives to farm and grow them yams and that sort of thing, and I've had to eat them too. They were virtually without fuel for their trucks, for example. They had very little, they had plenty of ammunition, plenty of guns, but as far as the day-to-day supplies, they were practically non-existent. They were very, very soundly defeated. And they had little option. In some respects, I tend to believe that they were somewhat relieved that the armistice had come. In fact, yes, in more than one case I've had that obliquely said to me by Japanese, when can we go home? Words like that. Will we be going home?
And what were your answers when they asked things like that to you?
Oh, of course, I'd just say to the officer, well, what do I tell them? They won't know if they're going back to Japan or going to wherever. He'd say, yes, tell them they're going. Or whatever he'd said, I would just translate. Well, it's a fact that they were ultimately to be shipped back to wherever they came from. And in particular, the were they Koreans or Taiwanese? I forget. But they'd been pressed into the war.
Certainly the Koreans had.
Right. Okay. And they certainly wanted to know, can we go home to Korea? And they were told, yes, they would go home to Korea. Mm. And ultimately, I would be quite certain they did, because the job was to get rid of them from the islands anyhow. It was a matter of logistics, just arranging for them to be sent home. How it happened, I don't know. It wasn't my task. But the Japanese shipping was very much depleted. They were probably sent on Allied shipping. I'm not certain. Mm. I don't know.
Before we go any further, what was your understanding of the way the Japanese made war? The understanding of the honour system that you were able to understand better than other people.
In what respect?
In the Japanese principle of making war.
Oh, Bushido, the way of the warrior. The generals belted the majors, and the majors belted the captains, and the captains the lieutenants, and the lieutenants the sergeants, and the sergeants the corporals, and the corporals the troops. And they did what they were told. Mm. Mm. And of course they had the Shinto religion, which was a religion of war as well. And on a lighter note, I had one experience. We were, two or three of us, I suppose, we'd taken surrenders and so on, and we were looking around at the situation at the camp and so on, and suddenly we come around a corner, and here are women. A group of women sitting there, all dressed up in white. And I said to the Japanese officer, and who are these? What's this lot here? And he said, oh, in Japanese, they're Red Cross, Sekijuji, and hospital staff. So I told the officer with me, I said, he says they're Red Cross personnel and hospital staff. And I said, they're the funniest looking hospital staff and Red Cross that ever I saw in my life. They were tarted up, they had lipstick on and rouge on their cheeks and goodness knows what. So I said to him, look, I smell a bit of a rat here. I'd like to question these women. He said, don't waste your time, Sergeant, let's go. And I said, oh, all right. And of course, what they were was comfort women. The penny, it occurred to me later on. And that's an example of where I'm sure if they'd accepted my view that there was something wrong there, and we could have spent some time once I'd had spoken to these women, I'd have found out. And actually arrangements could have been made to look after them. But anyway, I can still see that it was so incongruous to see these women in the jungle, and they'd all been chartered up for the occasion. I've often wondered why the Japs didn't just hide them, but they didn't. They had them on show. So, end of story.
Was there ever a moment in your interpreting, in your translation, that you were able to get close or speak on a more personal level with Japanese soldiers or commanders?
No, I didn't bother much. No. I wasn't all that interested. I had the job to do and we did it. And we were running against time on these particular exercises, and we didn't have time for, if you will, chit-chat. No, I didn't speak to them. That came much later on in Japan.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about that too, in relation to your position, obviously. Given the fact that you understood the principles that the Japanese held in relation to war, you went to war to win. You weren't going to war to possibly win. You wouldn't come back unless you had won. You weren't expecting to surrender. You wouldn't expect people to surrender to you. Given your understanding of these ideas, how was it then seen of the way of them, of the way they had treated POWs, or the way they had treated Allied soldiers?
How did they see it?
How did you see it in relation to your knowledge of that Japanese ethos of war?
Well, I had already touched a bit on that, because the Japanese ethos was never surrender, don't surrender.
What did you understand of how they had treated POWs?
Well, I thought because our fellows had surrendered, the Japanese would never surrender, or that was their ethos anyhow, that they'd thought that our Allied soldiers who had surrendered were worthless, for want of a better word. But that doesn't forgive what they did, but that's why I think it happened.
But in relation to your understanding at the time, you mentioned that you didn't get on with the Japanese because of this hatred that existed, this animosity that existed. What did you understand at the time of the way the Japanese had treated POWs? We hear of the Burma Railway, we hear of death marches, we hear of all sorts of different things.
Sandakan.
What was well known at that time in relation to the way they've been treating the POWs?
Oh, the Burma Railway was well known. And the Changi Camp was well known. Or it was well known to me, put it that way. Not certain when I became aware of, say, Sandakan and that sort of thing. But yes, I certainly was well aware of what had happened to our troops who had been taken prisoners of war. Not very pleasant either. On another occasion, talking of prisoners of war, we were at a Japanese establishment in the islands, and I forget whether I saw this or somebody else saw it, but there were two names, English, in English language, written. Sorry, but I can't remember the names, and it doesn't matter. And I on this occasion, I took it up on myself to make inquiries from the Japanese, and I found out by a little bit of persuasion that these two fellows had been US airmen, and there'd been a crash, an aircraft had crashed, and they were taken prisoner of war. So I said, well, where are they? I want to see them. And anyway, it turned out that they had been beheaded just about the surrender time. So I reported back to whoever the officer was. It might have been Dick Carnsey, but I'm not sure that what had happened to these two Americans had been beheaded. And he said to me, Sergeant, I want the man responsible. And he never forget this, he said, you can commit sodomy, buggery, murder, arson and rape, but I want that man. I looked at him and I said, well, that's very restrictive, sir. I'll see what I can do for you. Anyway, I had a fair idea who it was, and I got the culprit. And
how easy was that? Presumably you didn't have to commit all of those things to find the chap.
Oh, no.
How easy was that, though, to
well, it was relatively easy, because the Japanese wrote everything down, and they had I can't think of the name in Japanese, but it was a record of everything that happened in the unit on a day-by-day basis. And I demanded this book, and I read it, and I found the name of the character involved, and I said, I want him. And he turned up. And then I said, righto, I want the bodies. Where are the bodies of these Americans? And he pointed wherever. I said, right. Well, I want you to arrange for them to be exhumed, and I want them in as good a coffins as you can possibly make, and I want it done by tomorrow morning. Anyway, I went back the next morning, and sure enough, they'd made a couple of coffins, and they'd made a couple of crude American flags, believe it or not, and the coffins were draped with an American flag, each one, and ultimately, the very shortly after, the remains and the fellow who'd beheaded them were all handed over to the Americans, and I don't know what happened after that. You can leave it to your own imagination what would have happened. I often thought I should have kept a record of their names, and I could easily have made contact with their families. I think they could very well have been interested in how the bodies were recovered, and they would no doubt be now in an American war cemetery somewhere.
In relation to that situation, being privy to a book that gives the day-to-day running on a particular unit, what other things were you able to glean from that book or other books like it?
During the war, if one was captured, you could gather all sorts of information. You'd have to sit down and really read it. In this instance, I didn't have much time. I was only after one thing, and I concentrated on that. But when we were translating in Indrapilli, if we came across a book like that, we'd pore over it, and you could glean all sorts of information which could be of value to our intelligence people. I must
I wanted to ask whether there have been any other situations where you've been able to find out information about other POWs and their whereabouts or the treatment of them from books such as the one you mentioned.
No, that's the only occasion that I used that particular book in the field. But as I said, we just seemed to be doing everything on the run. And there was no time for intensive study of books such as that. And the war was over too.
How then were the Japanese being treated on the whole?
By whom?
By the Allies.
I think they were being treated as Tom Blamey, as you read out for Tom Blamey, that they would be treated without the respect, without high respect because of what they had done. They just couldn't be respected, and they were certainly hated by the indigenous people. They were in a no-win situation.
Were you ever in a position or a situation where a Japanese officer or man tried to excuse what had happened?
No. No. Not at all. But there was very little conversation, chit-chat, if you will, with these Japanese. It was all business. Mm. It was all business. There were no niceties at all. I might perhaps have a cup of tea with the Japanese, but that was during the course of the conference. But that was very acceptable because of the high temperatures and humidity. They had to drink and we had to drink. Not that I'm a great admirer of Japanese tea, I might add, or Chinese tea for that matter. Mm.
The situation in relation to, obviously, these conferences, how long would they last for?
Oh, it depended what depth we needed to go into, and it could be 10 minutes, it could be an hour. Mm. There are photos there of conferences. Would be the Japanese chief of staff, perhaps, and a couple of his officers, and Dick Gams, he was a major. There were a couple of naval officers with us. They could very well have wanted to ask questions about naval matters of interest to them. We also had an Air Force officer. I remember once we were going ashore in, I think it was in Dutch New Guinea, and I said, there's a big airstrip here, I think. He said, oh yes, but they can't use that. We've bombed hell out of that. There's nothing of it left. Well, it was in perfect condition because they had the natives carrying in and filling the bomb holes and tamping it down and so on. This officer was quite astonished, actually.
You mentioned one time when you actually had to rewrite a speech or a directed memo.
I didn't have to rewrite it. I did rewrite it.
What was it about?
Oh, it was one of these surrender speeches. And there was no mention, as in Tom Blamey's speech, about the ill treatment that they'd done to prisoners of war and the fact that they were not honourable. That was very, you are defeated and we are in the right and you were in the wrong, this sort of thing. So anyhow, I wrote more, or I said more or less the things that Tom Blamey had said, which I believe was what should have been said to them. And the officer involved was none the wiser. He read his speech out in English and they just nodded their heads. They couldn't understand it. But then I gave them my version.
How did they respond to that? Do you recall?
Yes, I do. They stood strictly to attention and drank it all in.
What was their reaction after the speech?
Oh, well, after the speech, we then would have had them dumping munitions and cannon and goodness knows what out at sea.
So what was their reaction to hearing those words being read to them?
Well, there was no... They can be quite impassive, you know, and it's very hard to judge what their reaction was, but they stood up and took notice of what I said.